Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefrey, and this is episode number 319. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Really appreciate those of you that like, share, comment. Just helps us continue to highlight the great people that we have in our profession. I also want to thank our sponsor, Train Heroic, for bringing these episodes to you for free. I only partner with companies that I believe in, both the people and the product, and Train Heroic has a fantastic product, but they have even better people. So if you're in the market, please reach out to them. If not, just let them know how much you appreciate them being a part of the show. This week, I'm joined by a legend, a guy that I get to call my friend, Liam Hennessy. He's the academic director at Santa College, but has been a guy that has helped drive this profession in so many ways. And so, Liam, just excited to have you on the show, man.
Thank you, Ron. Delighted to be with you.
Liam, it would take me about a year just to mention all the places that you've been and things that you've accomplished in this profession. But rather than do that, which either team, sport, year, which stop along the way had the biggest impact on you as a coach and really helped you become the coach you are today?
Well, look, you might be surprised at this, but back in 78, 79, that's a long time ago, Ron. Hobbs, New Mexico. I'm a young pole vaulter. I'm on scholarship.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get to the Moscow Olympics. I've been pole vaulting. I'm 18. What am I? Whatever age, 18, 19. I'm pole vaulting and I'm really, really fanatical about it. And there I am running a 6-mile run around the desert in Hobbs, New Mexico. And I'm halfway around and I say, what's the shortest way back to the college? So I get back, I run straight into the library and I say, there's got to be a better way of doing this. There's got to be a lot better way. So I rummage through the library, microfiche, okay, yeah. Magazines, track technique, modern athlete and coach, Fred Wills. And I say, wow, I said, wow, gosh. I started reading it. I'd say I didn't come out of that library till closing time every day for the following week. Wow. And what I decided was there is a better way. There's a better way of preparing for your activity or sport than just doing the standard classical stuff. And at that time, it was aerobic cardiovascular endurance preparation. For an event like pole vaulting, which is all about speed, power, and agility, and aerial agility, and, you know. So...
Sure.
So that was a bit of a moment for me, Ron. And I said to myself, yeah, you know, there is a better way. And it's through the science of performance. It's through this type of science. It's through gathering the expertise that has been out there for years. Now, in fairness, that expertise was Eastern Bloc. It was the Eastern European methodology.
Right.
Okay, Fred Wild, modern athlete coach. It was, you know, an Australian magazine. But everything was distilled out of the communist approach to long-term performance. So that was a eureka moment. That was a moment. It was a week, actually. And look, I haven't stopped studying since then. So that was one key moment in my life.
That's fantastic. I think so much. My wife and I were just talking about microfiche the other day, even. I think, you know, one thing, I was just on somebody else's podcast right before I jumped on this one. It's me, you know, kind of, you know, your superpower or whatever, you know, something along those lines. And I said exactly what you just said. I think the great coaches and ones that are, you know, especially when you've been in it for as long as you have and me about a decade behind you, we just asked a bunch of questions. We just asked a bunch of questions and we weren't afraid to seek out the experts. And I think for some reason that seems to be kind of a challenge these days. You know, I don't know, maybe it's because we're too prideful to not have all the answers or whatever it is, but I you know, I know you and I, we've had many talks, we've had coffee, you know, in England over the fact that, you know, we're okay with not having all the answers. We want to be able to ask the right questions.
Yeah. And the other thing then is there are no secrets. I mean, when we, you know, I'm here, would you believe it? I'm here in Limerick in Ireland. And I'm in a county that won the All-Ireland last year. Now, for folks who don't know about Ireland and hurling, it's our national sport. It's amateur. It might look pretty dangerous because they're 15 versus 15 with sticks in their hands. Now, right. At the end of the day, there's huge tribal rivalry between counties. And I'm a Tipperary man, and my county just won the All-Ireland. But I have no problem in sitting down with anyone from any county that plays hurling, and I love nothing better than to have discussions about how can you get better, and what is a different way of doing things, how can you do it this way, and everything is cultural and environmental dependent anyway. Right. So the way I would do things in Tipperary or somebody would do it in Limerick is actually going to be tweaked and shaped to mold the personalities, the individuals, the environment that in which they are, and we're a community of cultures, Ron, and no matter what sport we're in as well. And the one thing that we pride ourselves on, as you know, is communication with our athletes. And, well, hey, social media, the internet and all that, which I don't use that often, I must right. say. I'm just a bit of a Fred Flintstone on this. But my point is that it would be lovely to engage one-on-one in small groups in a community of coaches where you could share and you could say, no, yeah, I agree with that, but what do you think about this? I've tried this and this doesn't work. What about that? I don't know if social media actually embrace the true spirit of that kind of one-to-one or a small group engagement. I think the guys in the college tell me, they say, yes, it does, Liam, you should be working away more on this. But I just love meeting people over a civilized cup of tea, as my great friend, great AK, says. And when you have a warm cup of tea in your hand, you know, you're just more relaxed and you can see each other, you can engage with each other, and it's far more beneficial at all costs. Even if it is that I have to travel a couple of thousand miles across there to meet you for that civilized cup of tea.
No question. Well, Liam, you don't do all the things that you've accomplished without making, you know, some mistakes along the way. What's one of the biggest mistakes you made and how you learned from it?
Okay, well, I think one of the biggest, many mistakes, Ron, many of them. I have no doubt that one of the biggest was the assumption that when I was a coach, that the message, that the principle or the method or the approach was being received and it was a two-way thing. Assuming was a big mistake. Now, right. let me put that as an example. For example, we started with rugby back in 2000. This is just 19 years ago. We started camps that were really meant to drag, I suppose, the guys who were professional, but they weren't professionally supported in a sport up to kind of real international levels. And so I decided we need to go away. We need to rub shoulders with the greatest athletes in the world. So we went to Poland, where there were a lot of strength, power athletes, weightlifters, hammer throwers, wrestlers. These athletes typified the mindset of what I thought a rugby player would stand for: strength, power, agility, grappling, maneuvering. And we went there to get away from the mundane. And we were mundane here. But I assumed, without actually not selling my case, I assumed that, yeah, everybody would buy into this. Now, it took a little longer for everyone to buy in. But it was another message that even when you think, oh, wow, this is a great opportunity, you must engage. You must come back down to reality and say, look, even if you and five out of the 10 think this is a great idea, which makes a majority. You've got to bring everybody with you. It's not enough just to leave one doubting. Now, how do you do that? Well, that's a challenge for us. That's communication. So assumption, me assuming that, oh yeah, everybody should know this is the right thing to do. Nah, that was one of my big mistakes. I've made lots of them since as well, before and after. One of the other ones was that when you make a plan, no, whatever you do, don't stick to it. The best made plans of mice and men, you know, you could come up with so much grand design and everything, but at the end of the day, a plan is a plan. It isn't a dynamic human interaction. Great. And the dynamic human interaction needs to be embedded behind, above, front, center, underneath a plan. And it's going to be constantly tweaked. So what we do need is a plan to give us direction, but we don't need, oh, I don't know how many people, if they really hold up their hands, actually stick to the written plan. Yeah, maybe principles and goals. Yeah, you can argue they're very important statements.
Right.
But the process. So that was another, I think I'm kind of looking at that as well as a huge learning curve. Let's make a plan. Make the plan. But let's regard. There's a human element in this all the time.
Great. Yeah, I think it's so important. It's really a hypothesis, right? I mean, it's a scientific method and trying to throw ideas out and test them against concepts and make some tweaks and transitions to hopefully get what you're trying to accomplish. And I think that's sometimes what we forget is that we're practitioners, but we're scientists within the weight room as well. You know, you mentioned something in there that is something that I've been on a soapbox about quite a bit lately. And I would imagine you being, again, about, you know, a decade and a half or so ahead of me. This field was born out of a time when, you know, people thought it was bad to lift weights. They thought it was, you know, it was the concept of having a strength coach was so foreign to them. But even, you know, 20 years ago, you were you were convincing people to invest money and resources into being able to take teams of coaches and athletes to Poland and other places and to feed that knowledge base, to grow the profession. I think too many times at this point, we're on information overload. We got access to too much that people are too comfortable to go out and either invest time or energy into getting outside of their comfort zone. When, again, this field was born out of a bunch of rebels that kind of got out of their comfort zone and created something from nothing. What advice do you have for the young coaches, you know, coming up through the ranks right now, and with your work at Santanta, I mean, that's what you see almost on a daily basis. What advice do you have to them to not only learn new concepts and meet new people and those types of things, but really take this field to the next level and grow the profession?
Wow. Well, look, here's one, and it's a kind of an odd one. I have the privilege of being with Paul de Carrington for 22 years now. He's a golfer, a professional golfer. And Paul Rick's father, Paddy, a Cork man, a footballer, I sat down with him on the steps outside Pádraig's house as Pádraig was practicing. And we had one of many chats. And he said to me, he says, do you know what's very important, he says, in what you do? And I said, yeah, let's go on, Paddy, give it to me. And he says, knowing what not to do. And I said, okay. Yeah, he said, look, you see that man there? He says, if you know what's not good for him or what doesn't suit him, by the way, it might suit somebody else, he said. Well, he said, you're halfway there, aren't you? And I said, yeah. So the more I thought of this, now it's not a negative. It's actually a like, would you train a sprinter like an endurance athlete?
Right.
Well, not really, because that's not the right thing to do. And it kind of ties up with my very first point that, look, I wanted to be a pole vaulter. There's no point in I running around in a desert. Right. I needed indoor arenas, technical, you know, models, and I needed the strength and power and speed. And so the model that I'm looking at, if I know what not to do, well, it'll point me in a different direction. Right. So a question then is, well, how do you get to know what not to do? Well, you and I have the luxury of probably experience, and we still are finding out what not to do. You know, right. Because we've done something, say, well, I do that slightly different, regardless of what field we're in. So we're on a continuous journey of knowing what to do and what not to do, and then finding out again. But the other thing to complement that is my good old friend, the great AK. He's a physical therapist, and he says, look, and he's stolen this. All the best quotes are stolen, Ron. I pick them up and I tweak them. I, you know, I get out of them what feeds me. And here's one which I haven't tweaked in any way, is methods are many, principles are few. Methods regularly change, but principles rarely do. Now, that in itself kind of guides you. But how do you get to know what the principles and the core principles are? Well, hey, that could be years and years of experience, or it could be good study, or it could be good mentoring, or it could be good community of coaches relationship. And suddenly what you're doing then is you're saying, okay, well, it's the principles that really guide us here. There are many, many methods. And by the way, methods are evolving and changing and being repackaged, etc., constantly. So when we look at methodologies that are used today, you know, it'll be surprising that a variation of wasn't used 60, 70, 80 years ago. So the principles guiding, and I still, and I will say, I if you ask me, am I a scientist or am I an artist? I'm a craftsman. I think I like to see myself as a craftsman. I like to see myself in the middle of those two, not polar opposites, no, the artist and the scientist, but I draw from both. And I draw from both simply because the science hasn't yet kept up to the speed of the artist.
Right.
Because, look, 1996, my good friend Dietmar Schmidt-Leicher and Arne Gulick in Frankfurt, PAP, post-activation potentiation, the first paper, new studies in athletics. For anybody that's really interested in post-activation potentiation, get right. The new studies in athletics, 1996, I'm not sure it's the October edition. But it is Gulick and Schmidt-Leicher. It's a masterpiece of work. But that's 96, and it was the first scientific publication on it. Whereas in 85, 86, I was down in Athens in Greece at the first World Junior Athletic Championships. And underneath the stadium, I went under it because it was about 40 degrees and our athletes, it was a bit hot above. And they were the East German block, and they lifting 3 rep max loads in a squat as explosively as they could, and then coming up to throw the discus and win the discus, and then using the same barbell, the other female athletes coming up and winning the long jump, winning the high hurdles. Now look, we can argue and we can discuss and say, well, look, there was a lot more going on than post-activation potentiation, Liam. Get real. Okay. And I know there was, yeah. But yet the methodology and the principle, 10 years prior to Dietmar's outstanding seminal article, was being practiced. And then when I asked the great Bob Tisdale, who won a gold medal, believe it or not, in 1932 in Los Angeles, about how he prepared in his warm-up, he actually used to potentiate. He didn't know the word, though.
Sure.
But his methods and his approach amounted to that. So what is it? Well, look, science does inform us. It's hope, it leads us with all that it has confirmed or refuted, or parked slightly left and right. But that craft is, I still think, a very important part of what we do, Ron.
Great, great. You know, it's intense. You guys have been on the forefront for quite some time with really, testing the boundaries of traditional education. And you know, one of the first programs that I know of that went to a master's program completely online. You do quite a bit of progressive things with bringing experts in and having meetups and you have podcasts. I mean, there's a bunch of things that you guys have been doing that have pushed the boundaries of what traditional education has been. What do you feel? I mean, where do you feel that the profession and the education of strength and conditioning is going within the next 20 years?
Well, yeah. Well, look, there is a very obvious trend, but I even think the NSCA and the states, the community in the states had seen this as well, that the S&C coach is moving outside the sport big time. They're moving into that recreational area, that real interest that there is in the non-competitive, sport-wise, recreational activity. Some would even say it's not recreation, it's serious commitment, and it is. And it is just as professional in approach and needs professionalism. It needs very good specialists. So I think S&C is going to broaden. Now, whether it's strength and conditioning, you see, as we know it, is a much broader concept than just strength conditioning. It's much broader. To those who are not used to the terms or who are kind of slightly removed from its profession, would say, oh yeah, that's being that, you know, these are the guys and the girls who are in the gym and, you know, they're involved in technical lifting and getting you stronger. But no, that's such a narrow focus, as we know. But thankfully, I think the skills and the specialism of the S&C coach are being sought after outside of the competitive sporting arena. And that's a very good thing. That's only very good because it gives opportunity, first of all. And it gives then those who are not in that sport setting the opportunity to engage with and work with an S&C specialist. Now, right. if we look out like that, and then rather than ramble on, if we go through the life cycles, the S&C coach probably knows more about practical coaching, the skills development, the actual progressions that are appropriate. And what I see as well, I see some of the great guys that are in and around UK and Ireland in particular, simply because I'm probably more in touch with them frequently. Continuity. they're there continuously with athletes. And the S&C coach probably spends more time often with the athlete or the individual, being may not be in sport, than any other of the sports staff, because they commit so much time. Now, that time is a huge influencer. So whatever we do when we're doing it in that time becomes hugely powerful and it impacts. Now, you can imagine that from 6 to 96 in terms of age. So right. I think the S&C coach will start to specialize not only in youth development, youth athletic training, youth development, high performance, pathway development. I don't like doing it in long term because, as you and I know, Ron, 20, 30 years isn't really long. You know, it's pretty quickly. But when you move on up then into the senior ranks and the retirement, you know, if you look at some of the master athletes that compete today, they're phenomenal specimens. They're phenomenally, you know, master athletes in their 40s, 50s, and even 60s.
Right.
would have been highly competitive 20 years ago with athletes half their age back then, if you know what I mean. So, right. So S&C has played a huge role. So respecting that, and it has been an for others. So where is it going to go? I think we're going to start, and again, not just because I'm in education, but I think we're going to start broadening it out into more performance-related kind of, we're going to be striving to get human performance moving forward, and it won't be just in sport. Yes, it will be. It'll be in physical endeavor, in wellness as well, because the strength and condition coach contribute up to the life cycle. Across all sorts of voluntary, even when you look about, and there I say, going of an S&C coach.
Yeah, we lost you a little bit there, but the gist of it, I think we got. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were oil rigs, and they were talking about how they needed strength and conditioning coaches to, you know, we forget sometimes that it's part performance, but it's also injury prevention, you know, what we do, and a demanding job like being on an oil rig, you know, you lose somebody, you know, in that setting, it might be weeks before they can replace them with a different employee. And every employee counts. So I agree with you 100%. You know, being almost four decades into the profession, you know, you got to start thinking about the other end of the, you know, the retirement part of it, and the and really, you know, you've been one of the few people I asked this question at a conference. I had, you know, 300 some odd people in the room, and I asked them to stand up, and I said, you know, sit down if you can. If you can't name more than five people that have retired being a strength coach, and the entire room sat down, getting into that age, you know, when health and finances and retirement and those types of things are of concern, what are things that you wish you would have known, you know, 20 years ago, 15, you know, 30, 25 years ago, that to better prepare you for the moments that you're facing, you know, in the coming years?
Well, I think one of the key things is preparing for that transition. Des Ryan, our good friend down in Arsenal, Des is very good on this. Des speaks about this as well, Ron. But how do you transition from being an S&C coach? Now, my great pal Alvar Mail, who is a legend in the field, Al has successfully kind of encountered 50s, you know, I think he's probably in his seventh decade. Oh, hold on. I'm in my seventh decade. It all depends on what you were born in, you know, but, as you said there from your straw poll, when you asked, you know, how many know those who retire from the field, it's perceived to be a young person's, area, a young person's profession, a young person's domain. It need not necessarily be that. And I do think that not everybody who is coming through probably properly prepares for what's going to happen in their 60s or 70s. And that's where I feel one opportunity is always education. And it's educating in the sense of, look, what is the minimum currency that requires you to hold an invitation, you know, an invite role in an educational establishment where payment is made and it contributes to your pension. And I think not everybody is going to go for a professional doctorate or a PhD, but certainly an awful lot of athletes who become S&C coaches and an awful lot of S&C coaches don't actually realize the amount of experience and the wealth of it that's there. And there are opportunities out there for literally logging and creating your career. And out of that, using it as the base to get a higher education qualification. whether it's a master's degree or whether it's even moving on into a doctor's or a PhD. Now, what use is that then? Well, if that kind of thought process or discussion started at a much earlier age, that individual could start logging, that individual could start writing it up literally. And then universities now, even we will be hopefully very shortly, Ron, hopefully empowering coaches to look ahead and say, look, what am I going to do for my future? If I was teaching, if I was involved in an educational element, well, what do I need to do? Because that's what do I need to have educationally or academically qualifications to get there? And a master's level is a good, it used to be a degree was the requirement, you know, right. An undergrad degree. Now it's shifted up to a master's degree. And in time, over the next 5-10 years, it'll literally be a PhD. So I would say to all those involved out there, when you're looking ahead, do think of education as one way of protecting down the road, as you get older, the opportunities that you can have to increase your value, so to speak. Because that wealth of experience, allied with the academic qualification, very few young, lecturing staff would, maybe terrific on the sciences, but that realm of experience is so precious when you build up the decades of experience. So that's one thing I would say. Now, look, life, you've just got to be very, very business-minded as well. You've got to have a business side to make sure that when you actually are setting out on a career, that you're able to put aside for that pension, for example. So there's a business acumen and a business skill sets that I think we could do a lot more on in terms of helping our current S&C coaches, would-be S&C coaches, so that down the road, they've been able to look after themselves in terms of what's to come in future years.
I couldn't agree with you more. I've said that for quite some time, and stuff that I've tried to do in my own career as well. So I think that's a natural progression for those years of experience. I mean, eventually get to a point where, as much as you want to, the mind wants to, you just can't put 12, 14 hours in on the floor at a high level all day, you know? And so I think teaching is definitely a route that a lot of coaches need to be thinking. And I couldn't agree more with you. Liam, we end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Well, outside of Paddy Harrington's, know what not to do. I certainly think, and again, adding in what my good friend AK says, methods are many, principles are few. I think at the end of the day, be present, the simple little things, be present in the coaching environment. And it's one of the things I think we're in danger of missing out now, because technology is all around us, and we think, we coach remotely a lot of the time. Right. I think be present in the mindset, in the environment in which we're in. I think that's crucial now. It wasn't an issue years ago. It wasn't an issue 10 years ago, because we didn't have the little gadget. Oh yeah, we did. We had the kind of little probably calculator to calculate the jump height or whatever. Right. But we were present. Now we have a danger of being more remote. So be present, engage, get to know. Look, one of the greatest lessons I ever learned was when I was 12 years of age. It was it was from a sprints coach, McDonald Bailey, who Trinidad and Tobago, and then he competed for Britain in the 50s, was a world record holder in sprints, I think. But he came to our small little town in Capahoy County, Tipperary, for a coaching clinic when we were about 12 years of age. Wow. And the first thing he said to us, he says, I'm not here to disappoint you, but I don't know ye. I can't coach ye. So he explained what he meant, and it's so true. I don't know you. How can I coach you? But I get to know you pretty quickly, he says, because I watch you move. I'll give you some challenges. And by gosh, within 20 minutes, he had us fairly figured out. But he was present, he engaged, And he got to know us. So what did he get to know? Now, he didn't know, you know, I was from Main Street, Capital White. There are certain things, you know, he could use his eye.
Right.
So be present, you know, engage and get to know the fundamentals that are huge. We'll never go out of currency, Ron.
Agreed. Give us a book, app, and website recommendation.
Oh, listen. You got me there now, because I tell you, there is two books that I pontificate about. Three books. The Young Athlete by Fincheri and Bob Tisdale. It was written in 1935. I'm sorry, but it's a great read. It's written in an old kind of register of speech. But it contains many great nuggets about what to do and what not to do. The Bosco tests. Carmela Bosco, an old buddy of mine who was a great neurophysiologist, a super scientist. I mean, the Bosco tests and his rationale. Again, Ron, I mean, he was the man that, you know, that I think took that form of power, speed. Carlo Vittori was the Italian national sprint coach of Pietro Mennea back in the 70s. By the way, Pietro Mennea, whom they both jointly coached, he still holds the European 200-meter record.
Wow.
72 seconds now. But anyway, it hasn't been broken in Europe. And the third book is Principles of Sports Training by Dietrich Haar. I mean, that's a phenomenal book. That's okay. Yes, look, we have to accept it. The background is the socialist states of Eastern Europe.
Sure.
But the principles are articulated, and the graduality of the principles, the generality, the specificity, the interference, all the elements that we talk about in terms of principles of training, they're there. They're described in both a system level and in an acute session-to-session level.
Right.
So Dietrich Haar, Principles of Sports Training, 1982, 84, a few editions there, 1970s initially. And my old buddy, Dr. Helmut Bachmann, who was the head of the Sports Politburo in East Germany, he was a translator of that book.
Wow.
And I had the great privilege of meeting him and getting to know him over a few years after the wall fell, unfortunately. Yeah, but he was another huge insight into the principles, albeit, and I say, once again, there were a lot of stuff we don't condone and we wouldn't. But behind all of that, there was a principled approach, which was very interesting. Yeah, so there are my three oldie texts, Ron.
That's fantastic. I knew you'd get some good ones. I knew it. Well, hey, Liam, as I mentioned at the onset, you know, you've been such an inspiration to me and a resource for me through the years as well. And what you've done for the profession, what you continue to do with Santanta and all the work that you're doing now. I thank you, everybody that's watching, thanks you, and really appreciate you coming on the show.
Ron, thank you very much. Now, listen, you started by saying I had 10 years on you. Then you moved up to 15. I'm worried now you're going to push it to 20.
I figured it up as we were going. I think it was like 18 years or so. I wasn't exactly sure. I was giving you back a few years.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Good.
It's Ron, it's great speaking, great talking. And I must get over there soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey. On Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.